And I'm sorry to say that Andrew Natsios won't be able to make it tonight, so I will be doing the introduction for our very distinguished guest. It is a genuine pleasure to welcome Pascal Bruckner back to Texas A&M University. Pascal Bruckner is one of France and Europe's most visible and influential public intellectuals, as well as an accomplished and prize-winning novelist. The author of more than 21 books and countless articles and essays and intellectual reviews, magazines and newspapers in France and abroad, Bruckner is known for his acute and provocative assessments of current political crises and realities, as well as his trenchant critiques of our intellectual hypocrisies and emotional and human failings. And as his very recent best-selling memoir, Un Bon Fils, A Good Son, soon to appear in English, reveals, he is not afraid to turn a critical eye on himself and the familial and historical forces that shaped him. Looking at the title of and subjects of Pascal Bruckner's essays published over the last 10 years gives one a good idea of his intellectual range and erudition. The Tyranny of Guilt, published by Princeton University Press in 2010, focuses on Europe's often morbid fascination with the crimes of its recent past and how that fixation undermines efforts to deal with the realities of the present and future. Two other works, The Paradox of Love and Has the Marriage of Love Failed, published by Princeton in 2012 and Polity Press in 2013, offer fresh and bracing perspectives on love, passion, marriage, and divorce in today's world. The Fanaticism of the Apocalypse, published by Polity in 2013, perhaps Bruckner's most controversial recent work, focuses on the apocalyptic rhetoric of environmentalism, often to the detriment of the cause of environmentalism itself. For those of us familiar with French culture and the figures it admires most, Pascal Bruckner clearly merits the title of moraliste, and that is to say, a respected and often revered conscience of his generation. Tonight, Pascal Bruckner will speak on the subject of the return of the enemy. Please join me in welcoming Pascal Bruckner.
Thank you, Richard, for your presentation. Good evening, everyone, and thank you to the Bush Foundation for inviting me tonight. I would like to start this lecture with a few quotations coming from Russian media. First quote, death to our enemies. If we lose the battle, we will destroy the whole world. It's taken from Eurasian Youth Union, January 2015. Second quote, Russia is the only country in the world that can turn America into radioactive ash. That is undoubtedly the reason why Barack Obama's hair gets grayer after every call from Vladimir Putin. This is taken from RIA Novosti, Mr. Kisilov, March 16, 2014. Third quote, Warsaw is only 1,300 kilometers away from Moscow. Our planes can reach it within 2 hours, and our airborne troops can land there within 24. Our armies can also get to Berlin, Tallinn, Prague. We already did it a few years ago. We know the way. As for London and Washington, it might take some more time, but we'll get there easily. And this is taken from St. Petersburg, Channel 5, February 11, 2015. Here are a few examples, among many others, of the propaganda poured out daily by Russian media and illustrated by pictures of missiles looking like giant suppositories coming out of the silos and of cities burnt to ashes. Vladimir Putin indeed publicly recognized that he had ordered the deployment of nuclear missile batteries during the spring of 2014 when Crimea was being annexed so as to deter any foreign intervention, most notably from the US. So the first part of my lecture will be The Fall of the Wall as Immune Deficiency. In 1989, as the Soviet Empire was exploding, Alexander Arbatov, diplomatic advisor to Mikhail Gorbachev, issued a quick-witted warning to the West. I quote, "We are about to do you a terrible favor. We will deprive you of your enemy," end of the quote. The disappearance of communism indeed threw Europe and the United States into a certain state of confusion and almost amounted to some kind of symbolic disaster. Of course, one must rejoice that our favorite opponent let us down and that its demise allowed peoples to be freed from the communist yoke. But anti-totalitarianism was also a training in both vigilance and clarity. There was something both comforting and terrible in the hostility that USSR exhibited against us. Because that land embodied arbitrariness and dictatorship, the East-West divide cut off right from wrong as neatly as a blade. A terrorist attack in Africa or in the Middle East, an anti-American riot in Asia, a coup in the Caribbean islands could always be one way or another blamed on Moscow, the true brain of global subversion, hidden behind a multitude of smoke screens and front organization. And the Russian played the same game, exposing everywhere the grip of the Yankee octopus and its dreary CIA. Accordingly, the specific interest of a country, be it Poland, Czechoslovakia, or Afghanistan, could always be identified with that of mankind as a whole. Everywhere, the spirit of liberty fought against the darkness of despotism. But as soon as despotism itself claimed that it had given up the spirit of conflict in favor on that of cooperation, a proliferation of threats took the place of the unique but nonetheless exhilarating danger. At least with the USSR, one knew what one had to deal with. Nowadays, troublemakers are likely to multiply, coming from every direction. Surely, contrary to totalitarian regimes, which are always in need of an enemy that itself keeps on changing and reviving according to the situation, democracy, as a matter of principle, have no other enemies than the ones against which they defend themselves. They confine, they contain, they seldom attack. Yet the anti-Soviet crusade had numerous advantages. It mobilized individuals always prone to lose themselves in the comfort of peace. It lowered the apathy characteristic of affluent societies. It provided an appearance of meaning to a common project. Mankind remained whole, our shared concern, and we remained supportive of the various peoples trying to shake off the Soviet grip. The Polish workers, the Vietnamese boat people, the Afghanistan Mujahideens. Finally, the threat hanging over the very foundation of our social life gave an unrivaled salience to all that seemed self-evident, our institutions, our rights, our well-being. We cherished democracy as a good that could be taken from us at any moment. The need for security blended itself with the defense of a sacred cause. But with the fall of the wall, we have lost the perks of simplicity. Peace indeed results in a chaotic world deprived of unity, liable to explode in uneven fragments. Like two twins wrestling against one another, East and West could neither exterminate one another nor give up the fight, without depriving themselves from their very purpose. We remain today the orphan of that fundamental division. What Stalinism failed to achieve was brought about by Gorbachev's perestroika in 1989, the weakening of a Europe paralyzed by its own victory, victim of a sudden immune deficiency. Not only was it the case that NATO was going through a crisis when the annexation of Crimea took place, but Europe itself, despite Washington's recrimination, never succeeded in setting up a common system of defense. On the contrary, it disarms, although it stands at the heart of the stormiest of location, stuck between Africa in turmoil, a Middle East ravaged by chaos, and an aggressive Russia. On the continent, only two nations still have an army worthy of that name, France and the United Kingdom. But there too, many call for the drastic reduction of military expenses. In other words, Europe makes itself vulnerable, whereas risks have never been so numerous. For an enemy is a supply for the future, a way for a group to reassert itself by opposing something else. It is also the best way of reforming oneself through the constant rectification of the twisted image offered by the other. Finally, it is a certainty of lasting through the hostility of the other that, quite paradoxically, comforts us whilst denying us. Also, although nobody can ever be sure of the love of one's friends, one can always confidently rely on the hatred of one's enemies. Who could claim to provide, as communism once did, an alternative system to our values? Who could assume a symbolic challenge of that magnitude? Radical Islam, even if it abhors us, dreams of putting down Rome and Washington, as the ISIS leader recently said. It presently consumes itself in the long civil war that opposes, from Mauritania to the Indian borders, Shiites and Sunnis, traditionalists and jihadists, moderates and radicals. At the beginning of the 90s, we were almost forced to live by the evangelical principle, love your enemies. We quickly needed to find other foes. Such was the price of our balance. Let us be happy with those who want us dead. In fact, they might save us. These Bolsheviks, we ended up caring for them. We cherish them with some kind of morbid delight, just like some patients nurture their wounds and swellings. Because of its complete disappearance, we ended up missing communism with no hope that the neo-totalitarian ersatz in Caracas or Havana could ever replace it. As for China, it is today the facade of a revived nationalism allied to a conquering capitalism. It might even be the case that the dissolution of the USSR in 1989 had produced in us as much anxiety as its birth as a state in 1917. The totalitarianism that existed outside enabled us to feel good, virtuous at home. But where is evil now? Who would impersonate the devil? Maybe is it case that the Russians miss the enemy much more than the West, and then meanwhile they mobilize anew against us and display towards the Western civilization an unprecedented hatred? Or rather, the Russians despise Europe, which they hold to be ravaged by the gay lobby and parliamentarian decadence. And they appear to hate America, which he accused of attempting to colonize the whole world. 20 years later, the old world, which has succumbed in the meantime to some sort of spineless skepticism, seems to have rallied against itself two very different enemies, radical Islam on one hand and Vladimir Putin's Russia on the other hand. Both share the same resentment against the West, charged by the former of being hostile to the Prophet's religion and by the latter of having caused the demise of the USSR. The greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century, as the head of the Kremlin once admitted to Angela Merkel. In other words, the fall of the wall, which had freed millions of people from communist dictatorship, would be, in the eyes of the former KGB spy, who is Vladimir Putin, who was serving in Leipzig at that time in East Germany, would be then worse than the First and Second World War, worse than the Holocaust or the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But the parallel stops here. Whereas Allah's madmen reject the Western world as a whole because they judge it to be a sin, Putin conceives of himself as a hyperbolic Westerner. He abhors Europe and its decadence in the very name of the true values he pretends to embody. He flaunts a healthy Russia against a perverted West. All the evils that cripple Russia nowadays do not come from the Russians themselves or from the twofold despotic legacy of Tsarism and communism, but from a corrupting Europe, a malevolent America, and a satanic NATO. From the West, the symbol of freedom and the critical mind, he most all fears the democratic contagion and the exportation of a new Maidan in Russia, although such an event seems very unlikely, given the weak state of the existing opposition in Moscow. Second part, Putin as national Bolshevik synthesis. According to Slavophile ideologues, Moscow would be the home of the Third Rome and the cradle of the true Christianity that had been confiscated by Rome and the crooked strategy it used against Orthodoxy. Putin is neither Stalin nor Hitler, but some sort of a national Bolshevik synthetic product, with an extra dose of narcissism and exhibitionism on top of it, bent of dissimulation, generally followed by brutal showdowns and insult against his opponents. We have to remember that during the war in Chechnya, he swore to whack the terrorists, I quote, even down into the toilets. He kept his word. In the train stations and airports of Russia, you can buy mugs or t-shirts with the face of the president, smoking a cigar, handling a gun, or wearing a cowboy hat. The cult of personality multiplied to infinity by the culture of merchandising. Some commentators question his mental health and claim that he suffers from some kind of autism. But nothing in his behavior suggests any mental condition, quite the contrary. From his stint in KGB, he inherited a fundamental principle of Sovietism, the salami strategy, which allows one to slice the country one wants to conquer before swallowing them. Ossetia and Abkhazia in Georgia, Crimea and the Donbass region in Ukraine, Transnistria in Moldavia, and maybe tomorrow, if nobody stops him, a chunk of Estonia or Latvia in the Baltic state, a fragment of Belarus, maybe the northeast of Kazakhstan, and why not the entire former zone of influence of the Soviet Union. The return of the USSR without the communist ideology. everywhere there are Russian minorities, he claimed for himself the right to intervene so as to protect them, as Milosevic did 20 years ago for the Serbian minority. Bringing back unpleasant memories into the mind of Europeans, most notably the annexation of the Sudetenland by Hitler. And because he drew that comparison with respect to the annexation of Crimea, the historian Professor Andrei Zubov has lost his teaching job in Moscow, which immediately prompted the Mohyla University in Kiev to award him an honorary degree. All this was done in Putin's mind in the name of the well-known motto of Stalinist diplomacy. Everything that is mine is mine. Everything that is yours is always negotiable. His skill at dividing many countries of the European Union, at financing certain sovereignist parties opposed to Brussels, including in France Le Front National, at buying a Hungarian government, at flattering Slovakia, at cuddling Alexis Tsipras' Greece and the government of Czechia, which stand behind him, at cajoling both in every country of Europe, the far right and the far left. All this makes one think that he is indeed aiming at breaking up Europe in order to avenge the offense of 1989. Eager to take his revenge, Putin benefits in the West from a surprising popularity, especially in the French right, which currently exhibits some sort of Putinolatry. A judo black belt and a karateka, Vladimir Putin loves to recount his youth as a Serg and as a KGB spy. His authoritarianism fascinates the weak. He likes to parade bare-chested, riding a horse, to fiddle with guns, to swim in the Yenisei River, to fly a bomber, to pose next to a white leopard or a polar bear in the Arctic, to hold a tiger in his arms, to practice all sports from downhill skiing to ice hockey. The body of the new Tsar and its musculature must evidence the resolution of the leader and liken it to an almost superhuman character. The display of that hyper-masculinity has turned him into an icon of gay network, a somewhat funny outcome for such a compulsive homophobe. And that contrasts with the bodily absence of our own leaders in Europe. It is hard indeed to imagine François Hollande or David Cameron in swimming trunks unveiling their curves in front of ecstatic crowds. The cult surrounding the Muscovite Rambo in France rallies such diverse figures as Marine Le Pen and Alain Soral, worshipping that alpha male, but also Nicolas Sarkozy and Eric Zemmour, and even the far left, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, and the magazine Le Monde Diplomatique, which still considers that Moscow remains, right or wrong, the rightful heir to the USSR, the only power to have opposed during the 20th century capitalism. But there exists another unifying factor of that craze: the frantic anti-Americanism of our elites, be they right-wing or left-wing. In France, many would never forgive the Allies for having liberated us from Nazism and incidentally from communism. It is an unbearable debt that backfires into animosity. Hence, the need to weaken by all means available the transatlantic republic, the fall of which is awaited now for about 50 years, one year after another, and which is blamed for everything that goes wrong in this world, from terrorism to global warming. Was it not the call made by Émeric Chauprade, a former Front National advisor for international affairs in France, who once interpreted 9/11 as a result of an American Zionist plot? I quote him, "One must side with Russia so as to counterbalance the USA by way of a strategic partnership," end of the quote. Those were the words used in August 2014 by Putin when he welcomed in Yalta Philippe de Villiers, an insignificant right-wing politician, French politician, who ran the historical festival in his native Vendée, but who is also driven by a staunch abhorrence for the United States, and whose brother happens to be, by coincidence, the French Army Chief of Staff since February 2014, a situation that might allow the Russian side to obtain confidential information about our defense. In one word, it is not the love of Russian civilization, the passion for Pushkin, Gogol, or Rachmaninoff that drives a French friend of Mr. Putin. It is the love of the Knut, the fascination for brutality, disrespect for the law, the muscling of the press, the master of the Kremlin makes use of. Third part, the rebuilding of the USSR. Politically speaking, Mr. Putin has evolved. He started as a well-behaved reformist at the beginning of the years 2000, driven by the will to slow the demographic collapse of the country, to get rid of the two evils of alcoholism and corruption. But he has ended up an hyper-nationalist with an imperial bent. Such was a consequence of what could be called the Leipzig trauma, where he was serving as a KGB spy at the end of the 80s. He was utterly dismayed by the joy expressed by the former Eastern Bloc peoples at being liberated from communism, and even more so from the presence of the Russian occupant. For 1989 sparked a great movement of decolonization within Eastern and Central Europe. That is what he cannot forgive his closest neighbor for. Neighbors he considers the perennial property of the great Russian family. Just as if France dreamed of reoccupying Algeria, Equatorial Africa, and Vietnam. Just as if England wanted to reclaim India or Malaysia. According to Putin, there is no doubt that the Ukrainians, the Georgians, cannot leave willingly the great family of Russia. If they do so, it is with the support, incitation, and financial help of Western propaganda, and most notably the CIA and the Pentagon, which covertly conspired to destroy great Russia. Even in Ukraine, where everybody has a parent in Russia, speaks both Russian and Ukrainian, that feeling of having cut the umbilical cord is tangible in all conversations. Kiev wants to find in Europe a surrogate family, to forge alliances, to root itself in the great Atlantic momentum. Such a drift towards the West sometimes feeds a complex with respect to the neighboring big brother from whom one is now willing to distance oneself, and whose invasive concerns are to be stifled by all means available. As early as 2001, Vladimir Putin started issuing smothering love declaration to Ukraine, considered as Russia's cradle, oscillating between cuddling and sweats. I quote, "Our roots go back to Kievan Russia. Our brotherliness is no legend. It's a historical fact," said Putin. End of the quote. Russian Orthodoxy was indeed born in Kiev in 987 under Prince Vladimir. That was, as historians call it, the christening of Russia. Any move towards Europe made by Kiev would be resented by the former Putin as treason, a personal drama, the heartbreaking of the Russian psyche. I know that Kiev has dared sign a treaties with the EU. Putin, eager to punish such an ungratefulness, would like to reclaim not only the Donbas, but also Kharkov, Mykolaiv, Odessa, Dnipropetrovsk, and Mariupol in order to create a passage towards Crimea. That is what he calls the Novo Russia, the New Russia project, which consists in reclaiming all the territories given away by the Soviet power in 1920 and in trying to recapture all the Russian diaspora. But it also overambitiously aims at bringing into line Armenia, Bulgaria, the north of Kazakhstan, Belarus, Kyrgyzstan, etc. Everywhere there are Russian minorities, Russia has its place. Faced with that imperial thrust, Ukraine is getting off to a bad start. On the brink of an economic collapse, burdened with an incompetent army, crippled by corruption, by mafias and oligarchs with shifting loyalties, it also struggled with ghosts of the past. On one hand, the haunting memory of Benderism, the legacy of Stepan Bandera, a fascist and notorious anti-Semite, who created, at the beginning of the Nazi invasion, the Ukrainian legion that was to serve under the German command of the Wehrmacht, and who instigated the slaughtering of many Jews and Poles during World War II. Also, Stepan Bandera was imprisoned by the Nazi in Sachsenhausen after he proclaimed Ukraine's independence. Bandera, whose name had been given to an avenue and many statues in the city of Lviv, formerly Lvov, has been the object of a dodgy cult in Western Ukraine, even though the local far right has been beaten at every election so far. Kiev neither overcame the legacy of communism, whose deleterious effects can still be felt in the eastern part of the country, which is the Russian-speaking part, which remains nostalgic of the Soviet Union. Who knows whether Ukraine doesn't want to join Europe also in order to cleanse itself from the horrible events and to set up its own memory straight. Yes, it increasingly faces the indifference of most EU countries, whereas it at least hoped to awake a Europe of faith, as Ukrainian philosopher Volodymyr Yaromenko put it, failing to become one of its members in its own right. Only the memory of Holodomor, the great famine orchestrated by Stalin in 1932-1933 in the name of collectivization and dekulakization, and that resulted in 2 or 3 million dead, keeps on uniting the various political forces. Fourth part, the global conspiracy against Russia. Putin's ideology has evolved with time, as the Ukrainian and Georgian wanted to get rid of Russian tutelage. Nowadays, it is a kind of white, brown, red hodgepodge. It blends an imperial nostalgia, the manipulation of far-right group put forward when necessary, and above all, the questionable rehabilitation of Stalin, one of the greatest criminals of the 20th century, together with Hitler and Mao Zedong, and also the rehabilitation of the despicable Felix Dzerzhinsky, 1877-1926, a former member of the Polish aristocracy, a Bolshevik agitator who had been jailed for 11 years by the Tsar, close friend of Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, the founder of Cheka, the secret police that gave birth to GPU and then KGB, instigator of the Red Terror during the Civil War that followed the revolution of 1917 and which resulted in 3 to 10 million dead. Dzerzhinsky he was said to have coined that famous saying, I quote, "For those who do not agree with us, four walls are three too many," end of the quote. As for Stalin, it's not the communist leader Putin exalts, but the patriot who preserved Russia at war with Nazism, the heir of Peter the Great, Catherine the Second, the man who allegedly liberated Europe and discussed on an equal footing with Churchill, Roosevelt, and De Gaulle. The mass crimes he committed are now forgotten, buried, and modern Russia has not carried out any reflection on communism, contrary to Germany with respect to the Nazi period. What matters is vindicating the historical mission of the Russian people in the face of the hostility of the West. It will have to save Europe from itself and despise itself, even though it could involve striking the most essential centers of the latter. In the eyes of the Kremlin leaders, the whole world owes a crucial debt to the Russians because of the struggle against fascism. That fight cost more than 20 million lives and spared the planet the domination of Hitlerism. Such a claim is correct, but deserves to be qualified. The huge sacrifice made by the Russian people was also caused by the foolishness and folly of Stalin, who beheaded the Red Army in 1937, carved off Europe in agreement with his evil twin, Adolf Hitler, after the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact in August 23, 1939, and let his country defenseless, allowing the Wehrmacht to operate a striking breakthrough in the first month of Operation Barbarossa. All the nations of Western Europe may thank God for not having been liberated by the Red Army, but by the Allies, who behaved decently most of the time and did not substitute one kind of barbarism to another. Putin's famous quote on the Bolshevik era is quite enlightening. I quote, "Whoever does not miss the Soviet Union has no heart. Whoever wants it back has no brain." This was said in February 2000. Putin is the leader of grudge, and the Federation of Russia has become a huge empire of resentment, blaming the nefarious intention of the West for all its evils, alcoholism, violence, poverty, premature mortality, prostitution. Vladimir Putin shows no remorse for his work as a spy during the Soviet era and probably took part in the hunt for dissidents. He supported the reawakening of Russian culture, whose diffusion has been most notably carried out by Solzhenitsyn when he came back from exile after the fall of the war, but in a purely spiteful manner. His spin doctors have changed throughout the years. His special advisor, Vladislav Surkov, called the Rasputin of Putin, has been sidelined after the 2011 protests. Three characters play an important role at his side: a monk, Tikhon Shevkunov, the head of Tretensky Monastery in Moscow, the film director, Nikita Mikhalkov, and Vladimir Yakunin, a PhD in political science, who is also staunchly anti-Western. Accordingly, Putin's zeitgeist is three-layered: a classic kind of conservatism focused on family values, tradition, and religion, an apology of a Russian way tinged with messianism, and an imperial dream drawing on the Eurasian idea, Russia benefiting from the advantage of straddling on both continents, Europe and Asia, and therefore of gathering various peoples, languages and cultures, including Turkish-speaking community. But Vladimir Putin is above all, as French philosopher Michel Etchaninov put it, the child of a daily militarism. Haunted by a soldier's mindset, he considers the frontier between war and peace as constantly moving and rejects any self-reflection on the Soviet past. Since in his eyes, the fall of the USSR was a historical catastrophe, Moscow's duty does not consist in lashing itself into some sort of destructive self-criticism, but in contributing to remedy that disaster. Was once a Kantian and liberal advocating a close cooperation with Europe, Putin was enraged by NATO's intervention in Kosovo and by the overthrow of Gaddafi in Libya in 2011. He instigated the Second War of Chechnya in 1999, which was fueled by attacks in Dagestan that were in all likelihood carried out by secret services, but blamed on Chechen separatists. That war resulted in 200,000 dead and the complete destruction of the city of Grozny. Inspired also by the white emigre philosopher Ivan Illin, Putin dreams of a power vertical endowed with a guide and relies on the Orthodox Church to indoctrinate the people. The Orange Revolutions in Ukraine and Georgia convinced him that it was time for him to turn to ultra-nationalism. He links the demographic collapse of his country to the emergence of sexual minorities and vindicates Russian cultural immunity against deleterious foreign influences. His opponents, he calls them traitors, member of the fifth column, and indirectly and most likely orders the assassination of the most vocal among them, to quote only two, Anna Politkovskaya and Boris Nemtsov 1 month ago. His conservative turn has been completed in 2013 when he exposed a global pedophile attack aiming at subverting the values of Christian civilization. And so Putin has taken up the old debate between Westernizers who call for the imitation of Europe and Slavophiles like Dostoevsky, drawing inspiration from Russian philosopher, another one, Nikola Danilevsky, who conceived the relation between nations as a Darwinian struggle between species. Quote, the struggle against the West is the only healthy means both of curing Russian culture and of furthering pan-Slavic sympathy. Alexander Dugin is also another guru of Putin. He was the founder, together with the writer Eduard Limonov, of the Bolshevik National Front, a kind of far-left fascism willing to counter the Euro-American Empire and to fight the Antichrist, to the extent that Russia, according to them, was a nation chosen by God. And last philosopher who is influencing Putin's ideology, the far-right theoretician Alexander Prokhanov, born in 1938, who maintains that Russia, I quote him, is by nature an empire whose borders breathe. What a wonderful definition. But where does that breathing will lead Russia? What are the limits of its respiratory capacity? That is a question. A theocracy led by God, Holy Russia, would have to ally with China and India to fight against the West. It would thus create a global empire against homosexuality, atheism, cosmopolitanism, and the United States, of course. So I skipped the part about ISIS because I don't think we would have time. And I would like to conclude on Vladimir Putin. We might come back during the discussion between the links between Putin, Iran, and radical Sunnism. So what is one to conclude from that chaos? Europe and the United States after 1989 were willing to get out of history, to proclaim the end of the war on terror, to reach out to all the nations of goodwill, to resume cooperation with Russia and Islam. But facts remain stubborn, as Lenin once put it. History pulls us back by our sleeve, and we are forced to come back to it for fear that we decline. Left unattended, democracies fall into the slumber of comfort, the cult of private happiness, the tales of naive optimism. We must, in fact, respect our enemies and take them seriously. When they explain to us, as do Russian propaganda and Daesh, ISIS anathema, that they want to break us, colonize us, enslave us, convert us, we must do them the justice of taking them to their word. That is not the delusion of leaders led astray by insanity. Each time one deals with a very detailed program that they will implement as soon as they can. Do not let us fall prey to the same error committed by the great powers of the interwar period, which did not take Mein Kampf seriously and merely considered it the folly of a failed painter, a failed artist. That is the reason why we should also thank Mr. Putin and Caliph al-Baghdadi and Ayatollah Ali Khamenei and all the Iranian mullahs for their hostility towards us. They rejuvenate us by hating us. They terrorize us as much as they mobilize us. That is why hatred for the West is always hatred for human rights and democracy. And I remind you that the guerrilla Boko Haram, this name means the Western education is a theme. Boko Haram, that's what it means in Arabic. Welcoming the West amounts for those countries to leaving slightly open the door behind which lurk audacity and chaos, the protest against abuses disguised as tradition, inequalities rooted in nature. It imposes on each society unbearable burden, the duty to engage into self-criticism, to break free from one's past, to get out of the comforting cocoon of custom. It is despised not for its true sins, but for its attempt at redeeming them. For the West has been among first to free itself from its own bestiality, calling on the rest of the world to do the same, starting with the French and American Revolution. Let us entertain no doubt about this. The Cold War has resumed, and it is not cold at home, under the initiative of the autocrat of the Kremlin. Putin pulled off the amazing feat of reducing the outstanding Russian civilization to three key elements: militarism, corruption, and organized crime. State kleptocracy has replaced oligarchic plundering. Against Russian territorial ambitions, one will undoubtedly have to resort to an old strategy, that of containment, as it has been defined by George Kennan in 1947. The size of Russia, its military power, forbid direct confrontation. Neither war nor peace, but a continuous trial of strengths, cooperation under tension, a partnership in mistrust. And quite predictably, the imperative need to increase economic sanctions against Moscow, to supply Ukraine with weapons, so as to balance the forces at play, to strengthen the eastern borders of Europe, and to threaten Moscow with the harshest retaliation available in case Poland, Baltic states, or Moldavia were attacked. A military alliance between Moscow, Damas, and Tehran and the Hezbollah is not to be excluded at all and might well make us regret Daesh, rage, jihadist, in case of ISIS, be defeated by the end of this war, which is not certain at all. What cannot help hoping is that one day Russia will give up its imperial dream and rather aim at distinguishing itself by means of its culture and talents. In the meantime, one is forced to acknowledge that Ukraine, Moldavia, Georgia are the heirs to the great anti-colonialist struggles of the 20th century. In any case, let us recognize that two enemies of ours are born and that they help us being vigilant again. The possible collusion in their hatred for us remains an open question, since even Moscow advocates an alliance between Islam and the Orthodox Church against Rome and the spirit of the Enlightenment. Like radical Islam, it emphasizes the argument of the humiliation of the Russian nation without ever questioning the responsibility the people and its elites might have in their misfortune. And similarly, it might well turn out that what has been once pompously called the Arabic Muslim humiliation is nothing more than an apology to diversity, the stark realization that a good part of the world does not follow the teachings of the Prophet and will never follow them, is not in the least concerned by them, and therefore must be either punished on or converted by force. The enemy puts us in the contradictory position of both wanting to defeat it and wanting to preserve it so as to maintain the energy it provides us with. It is both detestable and desirable. It is in the midst of the greatest hardship that a people reveals itself. Such a conjunction of threats can destroy us, but it might also force Europe to take control of its own destiny, the United States to wake up, and these two powers to cooperate. If America were to collapse tomorrow, Europe would fall like a house of cards. It would return to the same dithering it showed in Munich in 1938 and be reduced to a deluxe sanatorium ready to allow itself to be torn apart piece by all sorts of predators. And if Europe were to be dismembered in this way, America's prospect would not be bright either. It would stiffen in a touching nationalism, isolationism. On the other hand, every time Europe and America cooperate on a specific project, like the present collaboration between the Pentagon and the French army in the Gulf and sub-Saharan Africa, they achieve marvelous results. Nothing allows us to expect the progressive extinction of wars, which are neither caused by climate change or the economy, but indeed and always by ideology. In September 2014, President Putin told President Poroshenko, the head of Ukraine, that, I quote, if he wanted it, Russian troops could get in 2 days, not only in Kiev, but also in Riga, Vilnius, Tallinn, Warsaw, and Bucharest, end of the quote. A few days earlier, President Barack Obama had claimed in the Baltic states that, I quote, the defense of Tallinn, Riga, and Vilnius is as important as the defense of Berlin, Paris, and London. You have already lost your independence once. With NATO, you will never lose it again. In the long run, Putin might prove a more dangerous enemy than the guerrilla soldiers of the Islamic State, for he possesses the atomic bomb, but without the spirit of dissuasion that generally goes along with it, acting exactly like Dr. Strangelove, always ready to go for extreme measures. The events in Ukraine unmistakably remind us, I said it before, of the Yugoslavian War, that raged between 1991 and 2000, as well as the ultra-nationalist propaganda of Belgrade, which presented the Serbian people as a victim of a global conspiracy run by Europe, the Vatican, Washington, etc. Same tricks, same motivation, the same paranoid megalomania. But Putin is more of a tactician than Milosevic was. He's a first-rate despot, whereas Milosevic, more boorish, acted like an apparatchik overwhelmed by the course of history. The master of the Kremlin is possessed, to take up the title of one of Dostoevsky's novel, but in a cold, perverted way, both an abuser and someone who endlessly lectures others. He started the fight. We must retaliate within the limits set by reason, but without being weak or accommodating. We must prepare for the worst in order to avoid it. Thank you.
We'll take some questions. The microphones are on both sides there.
You referred to the Americans and the French collaborating in Africa and in the Gulf. More precisely, what were you referring to?
So the Islamic State is a much smaller threat in relation to its neighbors, militarily speaking, than Russia is. Is it really appropriate? we see by the last several months, this new threat, or this threat in the Middle East, has inspired regional Sunni governments to